on their own tower, they could see the central tower even from the edge of the city. The 30-story edifice was the tallest building in the astral space by a factor of 6.
"As you all saw descending the tower after your arrival," Clive said, "it isn't a building in the traditional sense. Only the bottom floors have space for occupation, and even they only have doorways with no doors."
They had all arrived at the astral space through the portal Clive had appropriated from a tower like the one on which they stood. Since then, he had done a more thorough job of keeping it open, compared to the rushed connection they had made on their initial escape.
"When the Builder started taking control of this place," Clive said, "we had no means to seize that control. The best we could do was interfere with his intermediary mechanism, the central tower, inverting the considerable energies involved. This caused the vehicle to draw away from our world instead of breaching it. Using the towers of the Order of the Reaper, built around the Builder's giant golems, was just a bonus, as was siphoning off enough power to fuel a portal. If the dimensional forces involved hadn't been just right, and if the Order of the Reaper hadn't designed these portals to use the golems as a power source, then my team and I would have died without ever escaping this place. Frankly, I'm amazed that it worked at all. I really hadn't expected it to."
"You never told us that," Neil called out from behind the assembled Magic Society people.
"What good would that have done?" Clive asked him.
"I could have played the odds," Neil said. "Thrown in with the Builder and sold the rest of you out."
The assembled strangers looked at Neil with shocked disbelief, as did Cassandra standing next to him. His team just shook their heads. Pranesh was the first to detect the approaching adventurers with his silver rank senses. They were bronze rank, moving fast, their auras flecked with panic. Then he sensed the wave of monsters following after them.
"Idiots," he muttered, shaking his head.
The point of not using the locals was to avoid stupid mistakes.
"What is it?" Humphrey asked.
"It looks like the patrol team ran into one of those monster packs still roaming around," Pranesh said. "They've led it right back here."
"I thought you people were meant to be the good adventurers," Neil said, overhearing.
"We were," Pranesh said.
He called out for the group's attention and explained the imminent situation.
"There is a wave of monsters heading this way. From the proportions I'm sensing, 2/3 of the pack are bronze rank and the rest are silver. As for absolute numbers, I'm not sure, but it's a lot. Adventurers, gather on me. Magic Society people, gather at the center of the tower. Unless the pack has flyers amongst them, we'll make sure the fighting doesn't get near you."
Clive left the scholars to join his team, lining up at the edge of the tower. Lorelei followed, looking concerned.
"You don't have to fight," she assured him.
"You don't get it," Neil said. "We're here to kick ass and chew bubblegum, and we never actually found out what bubblegum was."
"You have gotten so weird," Cassandra told Neil. "You used to be the sensible one. You're a lot more like Jason now."
"I think he always was," Humphrey said, as he conjured his dragon armor and giant wing sword. "He just never had the chance to be himself when he had your brother to deal with. Too much responsibility and too few people to rely on. Now he can afford to let himself loose a little."
"I think he may have gotten a little too loose," Cassandra said.
"You know I'm still right here," Neil said. "You're talking about me like I'm a child with behaviour problems."
"Can't imagine why," Sophie said.
They lined up on the edge of the tower as their senses began to pick up the oncoming monsters.
"This is good," Sophie said. "I haven't killed a monster in more than a week and it was starting to feel weird."
"This monster train is what we did to the Builder cult," Belinda said. "You don't suppose this is some leftover cult people getting their own back?"
"I hope so," Sophie said. "I never got the chance to thank them as thoroughly as I wanted to."
"I've never faced this many monsters before," Cassandra said.
Neil reached out and gave her hand a reassuring squeeze.
"Don't worry," he told her. "This is what we do."
The adventurers confronting the monster wave were caught up in a sprawling pitched battle that filled the overgrown streets and spread into the ruined buildings.
The monsters held a massive advantage in numbers, as well as in rank, with numerous silver rankers amongst them. There were no second-rate adventurers present, however, only elites. They were not overwhelmed. Many of the bronze rankers were able to go one-on-one against the silver rank monsters, although there was no such thing as a clean fight amongst the chaos. The only silver rank adventurer, Pranesh, was a literal dervish of swords. Surrounded by conjured swords, they whirled around him like a dust devil of steel, carving a path through the battlefield. He served as a pressure valve for the adventurers, stepping in when fights got too hairy. The ranged attackers, like Clive, had prime position atop the high tower. Clive himself had set up a row of ritual circles to empower the ranged attackers standing on them. He had added further circles, floating at the end of his weapons as he blasted away with his wand and staff. Next to him was Emily, the Celestine archer from Beth Cavendish's team. Her gold hair was trimmed short in a practical pixie cut, leaving nothing to fall in her face as her eyes darted back and forth over the battlefield. With a racial gift evolution that gave her the human aptitude for special attacks, she was conjuring magical arrows by the multitude and raining them down on the monsters. The power to conjure her deadly Reaper's bow had been bestowed by the Awakening Stone of the Reaper she earned in the trials. Her myriad essence gave her an array of powerful attacks that combined deadly precision with area attacks. Her gathering and onslaught essences were less discriminate, with powerful charge attacks and arrows imbued with potent explosive magic. On the ground, the other adventurers confronted the monsters directly. Beth and Humphrey's teams worked together, joined by Cassandra and Henrietta. The pair's own teams had, like them, returned to their homelands in readiness for the monster surge that still refused to arrive. The Storm Shard Pangolin was a silver rank monster that could send steel-hard and razor-sharp scales flying from its body, then control them telekinetically to create a storm of blades. The effect was not unlike Pranesh and his sword Dervish, but the scale blades were smaller and far more numerous. A trio of the pangolins were overlapping their blade zones, creating an obscuring cloud of biting teeth. The shifting blade wall was thick enough that even attacks were being absorbed, the hardy scales deflecting physical projectiles and absorbing magic. With multiple monsters in the same space, even area effects weren't breaking through. Sophie had learned important lessons from her battles in the astral space. The biggest one was that avoiding attacks would only get her so far if she did so little damage that the enemy could ignore her and go after the team. It was the hard-fought battles against silver rank enemies that had taught her how to ramp up her damage if the enemies were up to the task. She dashed into the middle of the blade storm, knowing that just a few seconds of exposure would tear her to ribbons. She activated her moment of oneness power, absorbing all the damage she took for 2 seconds, after which she had 4 more seconds to deliver that damage against an opponent in an attack, or suffer it all retroactively. The scale blades blasted her like rain in a hurricane, even as she pushed through the dense cloud at speed. Her scant seconds of protection ended before she could break through, and for a fleeting moment was subject to the full fury of the blades. They slashed open her armor and flesh alike, leaving her cut and bloody in an instant. It was only a moment before she reached the eye of the storm, close enough to the monsters that they would not risk cutting themselves with their wild blades. Their control was crude, so they gave themselves a comfortable margin, especially with 3 together combining efforts. It had only been a single moment that Sophie was subjected to the razor cloud, but it was enough to leave her a ragged, bloody wreck. Her expensive bronze rank armor was in tatters, while the flesh under it had fared little better. By the time she reached the pangolins, she was painted red in her own blood, her silver hair looking like a sword bloodied in battle. The weakness of the Storm Shard Pangolin was that in casting off its scales, it was left vulnerable to anything that made it pass the blade wall. Only the head retained scales, and Sophie could have ignored it to go for the exposed body. But she didn't. A bloody fist landed on the long face of the middle pangolin. Sophie had been subjected to countless attacks from the blades, immediately pushing her karmic warrior ability to its limits. The damage reduction it gave her was the only reason she was still standing after making it through the blades, bloody and ragged as she was. The real reason she subjected herself to such suffering, though, was the ramping increase the ability gave to her power and spirit attributes. With the ability pushed to its maximum, her power and spirit attributes now rivaled a silver ranker, giving her a spirit coin-like boost without the short duration or the backlash. Sophie didn't just release the damage absorbed by her moment of oneness power in the punch she landed on the pangolin. She also unleashed her counter-execute, Deny the Reaper. The effect of the ability was massively inflated by her severely injured state. Sophie's ability was enhanced as Neil sent her a bolster power from somewhere else in the battlefield, flooding her with power. The healer's ability to monitor a sprawling battle and pick the perfect moment for his abilities had been refined by their experiences in the astral space. His timing was now sharper than the scale blades of the pangolins. The result of these cumulative effects coming together in Sophie's fist was an explosion of damage, no small part of which was transcendent, right into the creature's skull. Sophie's boundary breaker power eliminated the damage reduction from rank disparity, and the transcendent damage would have ignored it anyway. Even so, silver rank was silver rank, and the monster didn't die. Sufficient damage from a single strike to inflict sufficiently massive head trauma that could have a monster fall comatose would be startling enough from a silver ranker, let alone a bronze. That it was a defense specialist rather than an attacker was all the more startling. Sophie was recovering fast with a massive burst of immediate healing from her counter-execute, which also left behind a potent heal-over-time effect. Added to the healing from her karmic warrior ability, it left her in a far better state than her bloody visage and ragged armor would suggest. The other two pangolins looked at her, standing beside their unconscious companion. Even ramped up to the maximum, Sophie could only do so much damage on an ongoing basis. The kind of massive damage attack she just unleashed took specific circumstances and the use of abilities now on cooldown. She was undeterred, since all she needed was to raise her damage from a low range to a moderate one. If she couldn't attack hard, she would just attack fast enough to make up the difference. It had only been a few moments in which she had rushed through their defense wall to attack the pangolins. They had sensed her presence, but never imagined the bronze ranker charging through their barrier to attack, allowing her to blindside them. They had not reacted by the time the first of the number was felled, and Sophie activated her eternal moment power before they could. Time seemed to stop for her, and she racked up wind blades that froze as soon as she unleashed them. With her amplified spirit attribute, each was much more potent than normal. When she rejoined the normal flow of time, the blades gouged their way into the exposed flesh of one of the remaining pangolins. Both monsters recalled their scales to protect their bodies, cancelling the blade storm. In the case of the injured one, blood from Sophie's wind blade attacks seeped out from between the scales. It immediately fled, and Sophie let it go, turning to the other. It reoriented the scales on its body to cover itself in blades, then curled into a ball and rolled at Sophie. Such a charge attack would have been too slow to hit her, even if it had time to gather momentum, which it hadn't. The simple reality was that without the blade wall, the pangolin was far less of a threat. The largest part of this was that other adventurers were no longer held at bay, allowing them to move in on the beleaguered monsters. In the aftermath of the battle, Pranesh and Humphrey stood atop the tower once more, watching as adventurers looted the sea of monster corpses, sending plumes of rainbow smoke into the air. Neil alone had covered most of the battle in his aura, which allowed him to loot the creatures within. Since he lacked a personal storage space, he wasn't able to embezzle, making him a popular source of looting in spite of two others with looting powers. The spoils were collected up to be disseminated later. "Your guardian doesn't fight like a guardian," Pranesh said to Humphrey.
"She's always fought against anyone telling her what to do," Humphrey said. "Even her own power set. If she wants to attack, gods help anyone who tries to stop her."
"You need to get her to fight less recklessly," Pranesh said.
"She's fought hard to realize that she's strongest when walking on a knife edge," Humphrey said. "I won't tell her to throw away everything she's gained."
Pranesh frowned, but didn't try to convince Humphrey further. Humphrey frowned in turn. His secondary power evolution was a sacrifice power, and he empathized with Sophie's bloody dedication.
He had been forbidden from talking about that in no uncertain terms, both by his mother and a startlingly high-level Magic Society official. Humphrey and the rest of his team had all been sworn to secrecy.
"You've got the look of someone thinking about doing something for my own good," Humphrey said. "If you make the mistake of trying to interfere with my team, it will go very badly for you."
"Are you threatening me, young Master Geller?" Pranesh asked.
"You're damn right I am."
Neil finished healing up Sophie. Belinda conjured up a privacy screen with her power to create simple objects, and Sophie pulled off what was left of her armor. It was the only thing intact enough to stay on her, the rest of the ragged clothes falling away. She slung the bloodied armor over the privacy screen.
"That's going to take all day to self-repair,"
she said as she tipped a bottle of crystal wash over her head. She tipped the last of it over the armor before pulling on a fresh set of clothes supplied from Belinda's storage space, handed over the top of the screen. She looked at the empty bottle of crystal wash, remembering the man who loved it more than anyone. The bottle shattered in her fist, drawing fresh blood. Epilogue Chapter 7. A Time for Parting. When Isabella Pantero heard the bell on the door to her bakery jingle, she came from out back to behind the glass counter.
"Mr. Asano!" she exclaimed. "I was told that you died!"
He looked quite unlike his usual self, the confident grin replaced with a furtive expression dominated by a bushy mustache. She knew he had gone away on some kind of adventurer business, hearing just recently that he failed to return alive.
"Coming back from the dead is kind of my thing," Asano said. "I want biscuits, please."
"I'm glad to see you made it back after all, Mr. Asano. What kind of biscuits and how many?"
Asano reached into his pockets, grabbing handfuls of loose objects that he dropped onto the countertop. There were spirit coins, iron, bronze, and even silver. Mostly it was roughly coin-shaped objects like buttons and flat, round stones.
"I have this many monies," Asano said.
"Are you all right, Mr. Asano?"
"Biscuits!"
Isabella sorted through the assembled debris on the countertop. The inclusion of a pair of silver rank coins alone was sufficient to empty out the store and then some.
"Mr. Asano, this is far more than enough for all the biscuits we have."
Asano's face lit up. Soon after, he was navigating his way out of the store with multiple bags clutched in each hand.
"Mr. Asano, what about the rest of your money?"
Isabella called out as he awkwardly navigated the door.
"Thank you, nice lady,"
Asano responded, stepping outside.
"I got them."
He hurried out of sight, only to pass in front of the glass storefront moments later, riding what appeared to be a flying tortoise. As she cleared the coins and other objects from the counter, she considered it to be at least the third strangest encounter she had with the eccentric customer.
"He's acting out," Humphrey said. "He misses Jason too."
"That's no excuse to wear Jason's face," Sophie snarled. "Does he not understand what it does to us to see it?"
"No, Sophie, he doesn't," Humphrey explained calmly. "He's smarter since ranking up, but he's still a child, with a child's mind."
"You need to make him understand," she said.
"Maybe you could do that," Humphrey suggested. "I know talking about your feelings isn't really your thing, but maybe you can share with him. It might help him to understand."
They were making their way through the trade hall towards Gilbert Bertinelli's shop. Under normal circumstances, Gilbert dealt exclusively in menswear. He had made an exception in the case of modifying Sophie's armor, which had originally been made by another craftsperson on Gilbert's recommendation. Gilbert had undergone a significant transformation during their time away, now that he was a full-blown essence user. His hair had filled out, while his physique went from plump and visibly squishy to firmly barrel-chested. He looked 10 years younger,
finally showing some resemblance to his silver-ranked brother, Bertram.
"Here we are," Gilbert said, presenting the modified armour to Sophie and Humphrey.
"I've incorporated the Hydra leather and significantly enhanced the self-repair aspect of the enchantment. The critical areas still have hard panel protection, but those sections won't self-repair as quickly as the softer armour."
"That's fine," Sophie said.
The armour looked closer to what Jason's had, with increased areas of dark grey amongst the black, although her version was still more form-fitting than his combat robes.
"Unfortunately," Gilbert continued, "enhancing the self-repair came at the cost of diminishing other effects, such as the poison resistance. It does now slightly enhance self-healing effects, however, so I believe you'll find it a worthwhile exchange. To be honest, I was somewhat worried about the modifications, but I'm rather satisfied with the result."
"So am I," Sophie said, then asked about the price. Gilbert was adamant in refusal of any money.
"I've heard what you all did. Not the details, of course. I'm not that well connected. But I know you saved us all from something terrible. Consider this a last service for Mr. Asano. He truly was my favourite customer."
"That's nice of you to say," Humphrey said.
"Oh, I'm not just saying it, young Master Geller. He genuinely was. He always knew what he needed, yet was flexible in how those needs were met. Firm as necessary, yet open to suggestion. He was personable, patient, courteous, and gracious. He appreciated salesmanship and was a source of wondrous materials. And, of course, was always willing to spend what it took to meet his needs. No offence, young Master Geller, but he was most likely the best customer I'll ever have."
Gilbert gave an awkward smile, having said more than he intended.
"I apologise, sir and madam. I've overstepped my..."
Both Gilbert and Humphrey were startled when Sophie embraced Gilbert in a hug, throwing her arms around his barrel chest. He somewhat awkwardly patted her on the back. Two men sat in a cafe just off Greenstone's Divine Square. Both wore the robes of clergymen for the Church of the Healer. One was Neil, who had long been a churchman. The Church of the Healer, like most faiths, made little call on the time of adventuring clergy with a lot of potential. The benefits of having high-ranking members outweighed the need to keep low-ranking essence users under their thumb. It was a widespread but not universal approach, with the Church of Dominion being the most prominent outlier. The other man was much newer to the cloth. He had been working with the Church of the Healer for more than a year, first at his clinic, then more directly in the last couple of months. Having grown up in an area where the local healer church was so corrupt, travelling around and seeing the church's work elsewhere had been a revelation. Watching the church's dedication to helping people had compelled him to join their ranks.
"My understanding," Neil said to Jory, "is that your low-cost potions are predicated on local ingredients? Does that make them of limited use elsewhere, especially given the rather specific nature of the Delta's environment?"
"It was never my potion recipes the church was after," Jory explained. "It's my research methodologies. If it was just about recipes, then the church would be better off leaving me here to cook up as many potions as I could. The reality has been exactly the opposite. I've done very little hands-on alchemy lately." He paused to sip at his tea.
"It's all lectures," Jory continued. "Teaching people how to replicate my results by researching their own local ingredients."
"And that's been working?"
"It's still quite early into the program," Jory said. "It took me years before I started seeing results. The idea is for others to do what I did, just faster, with the benefits of what I learned along the way."
"But you think people can do it?"
"Flexibility is the key," Jory said. "You have to develop your recipes in accordance with the ingredients you can get a lot of for cheap. That's the only real lesson, because most alchemists take the opposite approach. They start with the recipe they want and try to make the ingredients do that. Ultimately, I'm not trying to impart a skill, but a perspective."
"But what if the local ingredients aren't any good for making cheap healing and mana potions? That's what those people are after, right? Especially with the spreading conflict with the Boulder cult.
It's hard to imagine how the prick managed to recruit so many of them. Distribution is the other aspect of the church's program. I lucked out with the natural affinities of the Delta's magic, which is what inspired me to explore this as a field of alchemy. Not everyone has that good fortune. They have to make what they can make. That's where the church comes in, establishing a distribution network of cheap alchemy products. Whatever your people make will be useful to someone. As long as you have sufficiently robust distribution, you can trade what you have for what you need. And the church is playing middleman? The God of Trade is working with us, so we don't encroach on their territory with what will hopefully be a huge undertaking. The idea is to prevent the kind of gouging that relying on the usual mercantile system would inevitably draw and prevent the whole system from getting bogged down by cartels. And is trade all right with that? We struck a deal. The essentials, like healing items, are going to be shipped at cost. The rest will have small margins so as not to mess it all up. But the volume should still make it worthwhile. I hope you aren't trying to recruit me into joining your administrative team. Definitely not, Jory said with a chuckle. For that kind of work, solid logisticians and administrators are more valuable than essence users. The church has high hopes for you. They want you to get up to silver, even gold, so you can really promote the church's interests. Jory's expression turned somber. In the days to come, he said, we're going to need you on the front lines. Front lines? Neil asked, sitting up sharply. Are you talking about war? Haven't you already been to battle? Jory asked. The Builder cult may be done here in Greenstone, but we're a small part of a big world. I've also been hearing rumbling from the Council of Faiths. There are rumours that the other gods will declare purity a fallen god. What would that even entail? Neil asked. I don't have any reliable information on that front, Jory said. From what I've heard, it involves the other gods sanctioning purity, whatever that means, suppressing the church somehow. I think the idea is that the existing clergy are meant to step away from the church while any who refuse to are dealt with. That sounds ominous, Neil said. Yep, Jory agreed. I've only heard this sanction the gods are looking at in vague terms, but it sounds as bad or worse. I think the idea is that the god of purity either gets brought into line or is somehow replaced, after which the clergy who stepped away from the old church can return to the new one. That sounds way above our level, Neil said. Good thing Jason isn't around to stick his head right in the middle. Oh gods, he would too, Neil said with a wincing chortle. He'd run around, firing his mouth off and making trouble. Mostly for us. The pair shared a sad smile. I'm sorry we won't get to see it, Jory said. Of course you are, Neil said. You're not on his team. Then Neil's expression fell, his gaze moving down to his hands, speaking his next words softly. You weren't the one responsible for keeping him alive. In the morning, Jason's team would be parting ways, if only temporarily, to go off on varying assignments. Clive and Belinda would be working with the Magic Society, while Sophie, Humphrey, and Neil were going with Emir. The farewell gathering was held in one of the sprawling bar lounges in Emir's Cloud Palace, the largest collection of Jason's friends since his memorial service more than a month earlier. There were a few notable absences, people who had left Greenstone and only returned briefly for the memorial. Prince Valdus had portaled in for the service, but was once again back in the Mirror Kingdom, where they had their own battles with the Builder cult. Gary had retired from adventuring after Jason and his team's departure, returning to his home and becoming a full-time weaponsmith. He had also been portaled in for the memorial, but had departed immediately after. Rufus was unsure when his big friend would return to the adventuring life, if ever. Rufus's team had vanished around him, and he was left feeling adrift. He had thrown himself into developing the training annex project, giving him some much-needed purpose. Jason's team had laid claim to a cluster of seats around a low table, with Jory sharing his plush cloud chair with Belinda.
You aren't worried about Clive luring away your lady with the sexually charged lifestyle of the research academic? Neil asked Jory.
Nope, Jory said confidently.
The kiss on the cheek he received as a reward left a big grin on his face. Next to them, Sophie was sitting with Puppy Stash on her lap, absently scratching him behind the ears. As had been the case since waking up to find that Jason had died covering their escape, her expression shifted between unreadably blank and a dour veneer pasted over a rage that had no place to go. Humphrey, looking at her with concern, picked up his glass from the table in between them and held it up.
Without Jason Asano, he said, we wouldn't all be here. He didn't care what my name was or who my family were. He became a true friend, which was always hard for me, and he led me to finding many more.
Neil picked up his own glass and raised it.
He became a friend to me, even though I hated his smug face, he said, getting a laugh.
I never much thought I needed friends, Clive said, raising his glass. Jason taught me that I was wrong, as he reawakened a passion for adventuring I thought was long dead.
I watched Jason come in day after day and heal people no one else cared about, Jory said.
Except you, Belinda said.
The day I met Jason, Jory continued, he had the crap kicked out of him by a couple of priests of the healer, which he completely brought on himself, just to be clear. Afterwards, he grinned at me and said he'd rather be the guy that got his butt kicked than the guy who didn't. I knew that I'd never go as far as he did, but he helped me to realize that some things are worth the price we pay. He went and died, proving it, sending my most precious person back to me.
Jason saved Sophie and me when we needed it most, Belinda said. He gave us new lives. You all helped us, but without him, you either wouldn't or couldn't. I don't blame anyone for that. Who would go so far for strangers, for no better reason than we needed him to? And possibly because Sophie looks like that. She makes guys go a bit funny.
The group laughed again, except for Sophie.
Jason saved some of us at the beginning, Sophie said.
He saved all of us and more at the end. Everyone in this city. If I had the choice, I'd bring him back and let the city burn. I don't think they're worth his life.
Everyone looked awkward, not knowing what to say. Sophie raised her glass to join the others.
But he did, Sophie said, her somber voice getting lighter.
So, I'm going to try to live the life he saved, in the way he'd want me to live it.
The others gave her bittersweet smiles and nodded as they clinked their glasses together.
To Jason Asano, Humphrey toasted.
Epilogue Chapter 8. Old Secrets. Dawn was a Celestine. She had a startling beauty of a diamond ranker, with alabaster skin and ruby hair perfectly matched with her eyes. Her flowing robes were off-white, accented with muted yellow and orange. She was at the top of a tower in the pocket city universe of Interstus, in the city region of Furos. She looked out over the city as she waited for someone to arrive. Furos was a region dominated by the cult of the World Phoenix, which was completely reflected in the appearance. Interstus had no sun, yet light shone from the sky, making the spires of red, yellow, and orange crystal seem like towers of fire. There were parks that mixed perpetual autumn colors with trees that had actual fire instead of leaves. The flames did not consume the branches or cause any harm to the yellow grass or surrounding trees. The tower upon which Dawn stood was the tallest and most glorious of those spires. The way the light caught the crystal mosaic of the flat rooftop made it shine like a garden of flames. A second person joined her on the rooftop, making their way upstairs from inside the tower. Very few things in existence could escape Dawn's peak diamond rank senses, but she did not turn to meet the new arrival. Helsveth was a draconian whose glorious red and gold scales would have been camouflage on the crystal tower if not for a white robe, similar to that worn by Dawn. Helsveth approached the other woman with a humility rarely seen in the draconian people. She moved closer and bowed deeply, even though Dawn was facing the other way.
First sister, Helsveth greeted. Please, Dawn said, turning around, giving Helsveth a warm smile. Soon you will be first sister, and I will join the ranks of the Hierophants. Please dispense with the formalities when we're alone.
First sister,
you have much yet to learn, second sister, and it will be much easier if we can stand shoulder to shoulder.
Helsveth gave a nod, albeit an awkward and uncertain one.
I have a task to perform soon, Dawn said. I will be leisurely about it and take my time. In my absence, I will have you assume my full duties. It will be good experience for you.
I will do my utmost to live up to your expectations, First Sister.
I'm not the one you need to be concerned with, Dawn said. Acting as first servant, even in a temporary capacity, means it is the World Phoenix itself whose needs you must attend to.
Of course, First Sister.
Dawn frowned, rubbing her chin absently as she gave Helsveth an assessing look.
This is no good, she said. Clearly you are holding me in too much reverence.
Apologies, First Sister, Helsveth said hurriedly, looking worried.
It's fine, Dawn assured her.
I was much the same in your position. The lesson I received will serve just as well for you. You and I are going to take a trip, Second Sister, and you will see what is deserving of reverence. Come with me.
Great fiery wings appeared behind Dawn, and she launched herself from the tower and into the air. Behind Helsveth, wings also appeared, but these were green and silver, made from a shifting cloud of sparkling crystals that caught the light. She followed as Dawn flew over the city, before plunging fearlessly down, plummeting into a shaft that led into the earth. Helsveth dropped down less aggressively, descending in a graceful spiral. The shaft was quite large, leading underground to what was called the Arrival and Departure Square, although its subterranean nature made it a cube. This was the location through which all comers and goers arrived and departed the physical reality. The magical barriers preventing dimensional transgression outside the Arrival and Departure Squares were some of the largest magical arrays in existence. The underground area was lit by powerful glowstones set into the walls and ceiling. The square itself was divided into different areas, marked out by floating magical lights. It was managed by local functionaries, who recorded all transits and assigned travellers a zone to make the transition to the astral, with magical arrows to guide them to their spot. No one was exempt from these records, even the most vaunted of individuals. The square had no facilities for dimensional travel itself, offering no more amenities than being the only part of the city where dimensional travel was not blocked. As such, it was a space primarily occupied by gold and silver rankers who had the abilities or items required themselves. Despite dealing with such people every day, the arrival of the first servant of the World Phoenix was a prestigious event. Dawn erupted from the wide ceiling shaft, dropping rapidly down through the square to land heavily in front of the transit office. By the time she had been inside and organized departure, Helsveth had arrived more delicately. Dawn followed the directions of the magical arrow floating front of her, to one of the large spaces allotted for large astral vehicles.
"Have you done a lot of astral travel, Helsveth?" Dawn asked.
"No, First Sister. For the duration of this trip, you may call me Dawn."
"First Sister."
Dawn shook her head. Let me be more clear, she said. For the duration of this trip, you will call me Dawn.
Yes, Dawn.
Dawn took out her astral traversing vessel, which looked like a snow globe without any snow, containing a tiny garden cottage. Dawn tossed it out casually, and it rapidly expanded in size as it fell to the floor, stopping just above it to float a few centimeters in the air as it continued to grow. Once the dome and the cottage inside reached full size, complete with a living garden, Dawn stepped forward, gesturing at Helsveth to follow. Passing through the dome felt like stepping through a sheet of water, but Helsveth arrived dry on the other side. The air within the dome was pleasant and fresh, carrying the scent of plants and flowers. She followed Dawn along a stone path, through the garden to an outdoor bench. Dawn sat, gesturing for Helsveth to sit beside her.
What do you think? Dawn asked,
gesturing at the garden around them. Helsveth wasn't sure what to say. Although her experience with astral travel was limited, almost every astral vessel she had seen was far more grandiose. From giant ships to floating palaces, they had all dwarfed the domed cottage. She didn't want to lie to the First Sister, but did not want to offend her either.
It's very humble, she said.
Dawn laughed easily, completely seeing through the Second Sister. Helsveth was a rather unusual diamond ranker, with a naivety that most had long since eliminated. Helsveth was a rare and extraordinary talent, discovered and nurtured at a young age. Reaching diamond rank before reaching 40 years old was not an unrivaled achievement, but it was extraordinary. In the world where she was raised, she spent her life either cloistered away or sent out to fight the monsters, rounded up in their thousands like a game preserve. Her life had been made up of little beyond study and battle, both carefully curated to produce the person she was today. Dawn liked the remarkable young woman, but recognized that she was in dire need of seasoning. She did not entirely approve of the accelerated program used to advance Helsveth to diamond rank, but had limited say in the matter. The cult of the World Phoenix was neither a military nor a dictatorship, and while the First Servant was ultimately the leader, it did not give her the right to inject herself into matters not directly related to her own duties. Dawn did not like that all of Helsveth's challenges had been designed, her setbacks and failures engineered. Dawn was of the opinion that only real life could offer the challenges required to grow, not just as an essence user, but as a person. If nothing else, how was this naive girl meant to handle the political machinations of centuries-old diamond rankers? The answer, of course, was that she wasn't. People wanted a puppet, which infuriated Dawn. Serving the World Phoenix was a calling, which the old guard cult families seemed to have lost sight of along the way. What they had created in Helsveth, though, was a true believer. Dawn was of a mind to cut the puppet's strings and bring it to life. Handing over the reins of First Sister, even on a temporary basis, would be throwing the young woman in the deep end. Whether she sank or swam would determine whether Dawn would hand over the mantle permanently or if she would have to find a new successor. It would take some time to get her ready for that, though. Dawn had an assignment, but it could wait. The Outworlder was going home, so how much trouble could he get into in the little time it took her to check on him? That would make certain people in the cult pushing for Helsveth's ascension to the position unhappy. But unless the World Phoenix chose to intervene one way or the other, Dawn was ultimately the one to decide. Helsveth would need to prove that she could be more than a puppet before Dawn would accept her. She hoped that Helsveth would manage to prove herself, knowing that, regardless of the people behind her, the earnest young woman's intentions were genuine. "I've been criticized from time to time for my astral vessel," Dawn said. "I've been told it isn't befitting the First Servant of the World Phoenix when there is a rather impressive astral palace available to use. Do you think I was right to reject it?"
"I wouldn't presume."
"Then it's time you did," Dawn barked, standing back up. She gave Helsveth a sharp glance, disappointed and dismissive.
If you're going to be First Sister, the ultimate responsibility won't be with the rules, the protocols, or the traditions. It won't be with etiquette, and it damn well won't be with the people who taught you to be submissive. She poked Helsvith, who was still sitting with a startled expression in the chest. The First Servant is the last line, the ultimate arbiter before the World Phoenix itself. They make the final choices and bear the responsibility for them. Do you really think you're ready for that? Without waiting for an answer, Dawn strode off, further down the garden path and around the corner of the cottage. Helsvith was left sitting on the bench, staring out ahead of her. The scene of the departure and arrival square beyond the dome suddenly disappeared. More precisely, the astral vessel disappeared from it, having transitioned out of the physical reality. The dome was a pocket of physical reality, drifting through the deep astral. Beyond its curved boundary, the surreal and ever-shifting panorama ranged from the beautiful to the horrifying to the downright bizarre. There were myriad colours and shapes that surrounded the dome, rainbow liquid floating in wild fractal patterns, scenes that appeared physical in nature, only to scatter like mist in a breeze. Some vistas were nonsense, others startlingly real. It was dream logic made manifest. Dawn stood by the edge of the dome, watching. Fascinating, isn't it? She asked, sensing Helsvith's approach. The centuries go by, yet I never tire of watching it. You rejected the Astral Palace because our role is not to glorify ourselves, Helsvith said. Her voice was nervous, but had a determined undercurrent as she steeled her courage. Our purpose is not even to glorify the World Phoenix, she continued. It is to serve the World Phoenix. We use glory as we need, but must ultimately remember that we are servants, not masters. That was not what I asked you, Dawn said, not turning around. You asked if it was wrong to reject the Astral Palace, Helsvith said. But the question has a false premise. You did not reject the palace. If using it is the right choice, then you will use it. Dawn turned around to face the Second Sister. Then tell me why I still use this astral vessel, she said. Because you're humble. It doesn't matter what decisions you make, so long as the reasons you make them are sound. That is the responsibility of the First Servant. A slight smile made its way onto Dawn's face. Not bad, she said. You've got a long way to go before you reach adequate, but we might just be able to make something of you yet. As you might imagine, Dawn explained, astral navigation is wholly unlike navigation in physical reality. The First and Second Sisters were standing side by side, watching the strange visages pass outside the dome. Astral geography is to physical geography what a burning passion is to a burning fire, Dawn explained. In some ways they are similar, yet at the same time wholly unrelated. Metaphorical navigation? Helsvith ventured. Conceptual navigation is the widely used term, Dawn said. While you can rely on navigators, it is a good skill to cultivate. Your education was very precise, but you will find in life that developing skills you never intended can help you navigate situations you never anticipated. I was taught administration, diplomacy, etiquette, Helsvith said. I was also taught to fight. I know, Dawn said. I was the one who pushed to have you placed in more and more danger. Every time you made a narrow escape or suffered grievous injury, that was me pushing at your back. Thank you, Helsvith said. I know that I've been sheltered. It was only in those moments of true danger that I felt free and alive. Without those moments, I would be languishing at lower rank. Free? Do you resent that we've taken charge of your life? Dawn asked. I am powerful enough now that I could leave if I wished, Helsvith said. I've been given much and have no qualms about returning that grace. Serving the World Phoenix is a fulfilling life. I agree,
Dawn said, sharing a warm smile. Things won't be easy for you while I'm gone. You will ostensibly have my authority, but everyone will know that you're only a caretaker. The avaricious will push for concessions. Those who raised you will push for power. Those outside the cult will push for influence. All I can do is my best, Helsforth said. One way or another, we will learn my worthiness. Dawn smiled to herself at the earnest resolve of the second sister. Do not rush to judge yourself from a single test or a single failure, Dawn said. And worthiness is not a set value. No one is asking you to be perfect. Actually, they probably are. But you shouldn't listen to them. If you learn to pick yourself up and learn from your mistakes, you can do no better thing to advance your case. Thank you, Helsforth said. If I may ask, do you really need to carry out the assignment yourself, or are you taking the chance to test me? The mission is quite real, Dawn said. May I ask about it? Why do you have to go yourself, over one insignificant world, in one insignificant reality? Does one low-ranked man really matter? What makes him so important? Dawn gave her a contemplative look, then nodded to herself. It's time you started learning some of the old secrets, Dawn said. The key is the two worlds that the man has lived on. He belongs to them both now, at a point that is critical for both of them. The worlds themselves aren't especially important, but what they represent. You are aware that the current builder replaced the previous one, yes?
I am,
Helsforth said.
The reason that the builder's predecessor was sanctioned was that he had corrupted his purpose. The builder's role is to create the seeds from which physical realities are born. Our new builder is oddly dismissive of the task, instead obsessing over creating a reality already developed, whose inhabitants worship him as a god.
Will he be sanctioned as well?
Probably not. The reason the others accept the builder's fascination is that it leaves him performing his actual job with dispassion. This was not the case with the previous incumbent.
Oh? Helsforth prompted.
The previous builder became dissatisfied with making seeds that contained nothing but building blocks of reality. He had no influence, no control. This may be a flaw of the builder as a role, given that each of the incumbents has had the same issue. But the previous builder did not satiate those urges with a relatively harmless side project. Instead, he started meddling with the seeds he was creating.
Meddling how?
He was setting patterns into them, taken from existing worlds that would cause the universes that expanded from these seeds to develop in predestined ways.
And that would work? Helsforth asked.
No, Dawn said. The builder had only experimented with two such universe seeds when his actions were discovered, which were but early experiments. The others realized that he was perverting his intrinsic purpose, and he was sanctioned, then replaced.
Sanctioned? Does that mean killed?
I don't know what it means, Dawn said. I don't think we're meant to know. But I'm not sure a great astral being can die. I don't know if that's even possible.
What about the two universes? Helsforth asked.
They were early experiments, as I said. The effects were designed to be small, contained enough for the builder to study as the universes developed. The changes were restricted to two planets that developed in very similar ways due to being based on a similar pattern. One was more heavily affected than the other, but the two worlds had much in common.
Two planets.
One from each universe, but made echoes of one another by their common origin. Patterns from existing universes woven together. The basic template was the same for both, which is why these worlds echo one another in ways great and small. Those echoes linger to the present, affecting everything from the evolution of the creatures that live on it to the myths formed by their inhabitants. It is also why the more magical world has had a higher proportion of outworlders from the less magical one than from other low-magic universes.
Why was this bad? Helsforth asked. Did it cause any harm?
The cosmos has mechanisms by which it operates, Dawn explained. The greater astral beings are the manifestations of those mechanisms, as well as caretakers responsible for resolving problems with the mechanisms. They are gods of the cosmos. The previous builder lost its way, forcing the others to sanction and replace it before it caused a cascading disaster that threw the entire cosmos out of balance. So, the builder is unlike the other great astral beings, in that he was raised up to take a role instead of being a manifestation of it. Yes, Dawn said. It is why he lacks the reverence for his core task that is the defining trait of the others. But you said the others don't mind. A detachment from his task of creating world seeds means he will not fall down the same path as his predecessor. But that still left the two worlds influenced by the old builder. Yes, Dawn said. Of the two worlds, one was the result of modest changes. Left alone, it would show no anomalies on its own, live out its existence and ultimately end with the rest of its universe. The second world was a more comprehensive experiment, one that was more volatile. The world Phoenix was forced to step in and strengthen the dimensional membrane of this world, restricting the flow of magic from the astral. This was to prevent the abnormalities from manifesting and destabilizing the world. That is peripheral to the world Phoenix's role at best, Helsforth said. Yes, Dawn agreed. Strictly speaking, she should have let the world destroy itself and then repair the resulting dimensional breach. While she is aloof and above we mortals, however, the world Phoenix does not lack compassion. She did her best to save that world by strengthening the dimensional membrane. It was an imperfect solution that now threatens to become unraveled. The new builder, as part of his personal project, provided knowledge to a deity that was used to create a link between the two worlds, using their similarities as a basis. What kind of link? One that siphons magic from the more magical world to the lesser one, bypassing the dimensional membrane. It does not diminish the normal magical level, but the cyclical magic flood has been increasingly delayed, to the point of now stopping altogether. You're talking about a monster surge, Helsforth said. Yes, Dawn confirmed. The intention is to siphon magic into the other world until a backlash occurs, rebounding through the link to create a far more drastic magical flood than normal. This will weaken the dimensional membrane enough for the builder to launch an invasion from his own constructed reality. Surely he cannot be allowed to do that, Helsforth said. Not so long as he uses intermediaries, Dawn said. The people of his created world, his cult, even the gods of the world he intends to invade. He pushes the limits, but has avoided crossing any lines thus far. What will that do to the less magical world? I'm not sure anyone really knows, Dawn said. The builder disregards it as unimportant, a means to an end. He cares not if his god and mortal agents destroy it. He underestimated how fiercely the world Phoenix would react, so now he needs to act and prevent that world's destruction, lest he be sanctioned like his predecessor. The Outworlder. Yes, the world Phoenix cannot act directly and does not maintain branches of her cult on mortal realms. As is her way, she has taken various more oblique steps to remedy the situation. Of the forces she has set in motion, she has determined the Outworlder has proven to have the most potential. It falls to him, then, to prevent one, possibly two, worlds ultimately being destroyed. That is a lot to place on the shoulders of one man. Yes, Dawn said. Hopefully he can stop getting himself killed. Where is it we are going? Helsforth asked. She and Dawn were still in the astral vessel, which had been travelling for some time. Dawn had led her into the cottage and brewed them a beverage made from seaweed sourced from her home world. You have experienced the presence of the world Phoenix, Dawn said. You have carried a star seed within you for more than half of your life. You have even briefly been a vessel for the World Phoenix itself, as you will again in the future. The communion was the greatest thrill and honor of my life, Helsforth said. I am sorry your time as a vessel is coming to an end.
The first servant, in addition to being the head of the cult of the World Phoenix, was the primary vessel of the great astral being. Unlike the disposable vessels the Builder had used, the diamond rank vessels of the great astral beings could both withstand the strain of power possessing them and retain their selves after it had left them. Even diamond rankers had their limits, however, and eventually their souls could no longer withstand the power. This had no lingering effects, so long as they passed on the role of vessel. It even had an effect of strengthening the soul over time, leaving former vessels as peak existences, even among diamond rankers. Dawn gave Helsforth a warm smile.
The communion is a joy, she said. What we experience in such cases, though, is but the echo of a grain of sand falling to the ground on the other side of the world. To inhabit the mortal is to be limited by it. The great astral beings cannot show their true magnificence through us, Helsforth said. This made complete sense to her.
I suspect it is more than that, Dawn said. I suspect that the behavior of the great astral beings occupying mortal forms is profoundly affected by the vessel they inhabit. They broadly follow their natural direction, but I've seen them operating like this enough to conclude that their specific behavior is heavily shaped by their mortal vessels.
What makes you think so? Helsforth asked.
The fact they seem so mortal, petty, limited in a way that I might expect of myself, but not the World Phoenix, the Reaper of the Celestial Book. Perhaps the Builder, as he began as a mortal.
I think I know what you mean, Helsforth said, brow creased in contemplation. When I think back to my experience as a vessel, I could sense how much greater the World Phoenix was. It's like it needed to use me to operate, but that I somehow tainted it. I clearly felt that I was small and unworthy. You will understand better soon, Dawn said. I am taking you to see the World Phoenix in person.
Dawn chuckled at Helsforth's wide-eyed shock.
In person?
That's right, Dawn said. We won't be close because, diamond rank or not, the power it radiates would annihilate us. It will know we are there, and we will know it.
What's it like?
Helsforth asked hesitantly.
I've never encountered a language that could encapsulate it, Dawn said. You feel like the smallest thing in the cosmos, yet part of something so great and vast that your mind cannot comprehend it. The World Phoenix will communicate with you, but not like you've experienced through the starseed. It isn't some crude mortal means. Imagine experiencing the entire history of the cosmos as a language. I don't think I can, Helsforth said. Good, Dawn said.
That's exactly the right attitude to go in with.
This is the end of He Who Fights with Monsters 3, a Podium audio production. If you enjoyed this audiobook, we would love for you to rate and review it. For more heroic adventures, check us out at podiumaudio.com and sign up for our newsletter. We promise we won't spam you. Also, consider joining our community of listeners, fans, and trolls on social media. We're active on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and Reddit. We'd love to connect. You have been listening to He Who Fights with Monsters 3, Book 3 of He Who Fights with Monsters, produced by Emily Durr, written by Shirtaloon, performed by Heath Miller. Text copyright 2021 by Shirtaloon. Production copyright 2021 by Podium Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.